Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello, good evening and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. We'd love to hear from you. That's 087-179-1032. Lots to get through. As usual, John, and including, I think, the two big news stories of the week, which we'll get to, of course, are one that made the mainstream media is, of course, Virgin Orbit and going into bankruptcy. But less well known, but I think more importantly and more excitingly, is the naming of the four astronauts who will go around the moon sometime at the end of next year on the Artemis 2 mission. So I think we should start with the night sky as usual, of course, yeah. But we'll get to that exciting story in a moment. Let's start with the planets.
And a very good evening, Ben. Hi, everyone. Yeah, just in case we didn't get that bit in. Yes, indeed, the Mercury. When did they line themselves? Was it this time last week? There were all five of them lined up against each other with the moon as a guide. So we had all of that. So you would have been able to see them. Not necessarily all at the same time of the evening. And it would have crept through the night sky into the early dawn. So nice to see that as well. Mercury, it's a little higher at the moment in the afterglow of sunset day by day, which is great, above the west horizon. It's a sort of an odd planet to look at because it's staring just in front of the sun. And you can see it's just about half an hour after sunset. And it's far to the lower right of bright Venus at the moment. So that's a good... And you won't miss Venus, by the way. And, of course, binoculars may help. Well, they definitely would help me. Not so sure about you. And Venus, it is the evening star at the moment. It's brilliant at the moment. Magnitude -4, crossing from Aries into Taurus just at the moment. And it's shining into the west during and after dusk. Now, I did see it last night peering through the odd cloud. And it's creeping up on Mars. Now, they are sort of coming closer and closer. And it's quite interesting to watch as well. So Mars cruising eastward above the trailing foot of the Castor stick figure in Gemini. So if you know where Gemini or Castor and Pollux are, look for it high in the west in the early evening and lower in the west later. And it's the upper left of Venus, about four fists at arm's length. And that's bang on because I saw the two of them last night and I was just making sure that it was Mars because it's beginning to fade at the moment. And its magnitude is only +1 at the moment, fading to +1.1 this week. And it's going to disappear. And Mars is actually at the moment, it's nearly at the other side of its orbit from us. So in a telescope, it's just a little orange blob, about 6 arc seconds wide. Jupiter, unfortunately, is out of sight, nearly behind the sun, so you're not going to get a chance to see that. Saturn. The other hand, magnitude +1 again, the same sort of, we'll call it dimness in Aquarius, and it's emerging into the dawn view, very low in the southeast as the sky brightens. Again, binoculars will help you to see that, and it will get better as the months go on, so look for it far, far below a star called Altair. Uranus, 5.8 in Aries, is now a more difficult binocular catch as it sinks under the west below Venus, so... It's not a million miles away, and unfortunately Neptune, magnitude 8.0, is still hidden in the sunrise. That's going to elude us for a while, that one. So the two ones really that are hard to see at the moment, Mercury and Neptune. All the rest are seeable.
Thank you for that, John. Just going back to Mercury at the moment, as you mentioned, you'll see it as a very small blob, but on Sunday the 9th, it's at what we call a dichotomy, which means if you look at it through a telescope, you'll see about half, similar to the first quarter moon, you'll see 50% of it, of a semicircle or semi-disc. And that occurs every 116 days or so, when it's at its greatest elongation from the sun, which is around about 19 degrees or so, which is about two fists width at arm's length. Speaking of the moon, of course, we have a 98.1% waxing gibbous moon at the moment as we head towards the full moon on Thursday the 6th at 5:30 in the morning. And the moon will pass the meridian, or it will be due south of us, just about 20 to 1 tomorrow morning. And at that stage, it will have, well, you wouldn't notice the difference now. It will be 98.6% waxing. I suppose to all intents and purposes, you know, it looks full. You're not going to notice a difference between 100% and 98%.
I will.
You will. Mm-hmm. You're very, very sharp. Mm-hmm. So sharp eyes, yes. And when it sets tomorrow, just before 7 a.m., it'll be just over 99%. And when it rises again tomorrow evening at just before 7:30, it'll be almost full, 99.8%. So you won't know any difference. And as I say, it will be full on Thursday the 6th at 5:35 a.m. To be precise.
This one is the pink moon.
Pink?
Pink moon. That's the one that's called for this month. So we have names for every single one of them. So we'll go through them as we go along. The International Space Station, unfortunately, is gone for another month or so. So the last time we got to see it was about 2 days ago, and it won't be back in our skies. Let me just see if I can just put up cast a bit.
Okay.
May the 12th till the 28th of May is when we get to see it next. And if you're a meteor shower watcher, we have one coming up this month starting on the 15th, which is only 9 days ago away, April the 15th to the 29th, peaking on April the 22nd, and it's known as the Lyrid meteor shower, and these are from a medium-strength meteor that usually produces good rates for 3 nights centred on the maximum. So 21, 22, 23 of April, you get to see them. Up to maybe 20 per hour can be seen on a good, clear night. And the very good news is that the moon is a very thin crescent, so it's going to be really dark in the skies if we get a good clear night. And some of these can produce fireballs, which are another thing to look out for as well, so these are great. And they're best seen from the northern hemisphere, which is where we are at the moment. And the radiance is high in the sky at dawn, so plain to view as late as possible. View on Friday to Sunday nights too, if you can get there and do that. Hopefully the evenings will be clear. And, of course, the radiant of this shower is in Lyra, near the brightest star Vega. Now, most of us would know the particular name of Vega, and you'll easily see that because it's a really blue, hot star. And that was, in fact, one of the first stars I saw through the telescope of the Dunsink Observatory going back in 2000 or thereabouts, which is a nice thing to see. It's really only just a light, but it's still nice to see through the telescope itself.
Yes. Well, looking at individual stars through telescopes is not very interesting, but I get more. If you look at double star, they can be interesting because they're usually different colours, but not always, of course. Or some people, of course, like to observe variable stars because they, by their name, they vary in magnitude. And of course, star clusters, I think would be more common. I suppose people viewing star clusters and galaxies more interesting than looking at single points of light. The sun, of course, is a kind of ordinary star, and it will rise tomorrow in Dublin at 6:49 a.m. and local noon when it passes the meridian will be at 1:27 p.m. The sun setting at 8:06 tomorrow evening, which is 10 minutes later than a week ago, and from then we'll have a civil twilight until about 20 minutes to 9, and from then until about almost 9:30, we'll have nautical twilight astronomical twilight then until about 10:15 tomorrow evening when nighttime officially begins. So we'll have 29 minutes more daylight than we had a week ago. Tomorrow another 4:11 more daylight than today, when there'll be 13 hours and 17 minutes between sunrise and sunset. And just coming up this week also, on Thursday, will be the 50th anniversary of the launch of Pioneer 11, launched obviously, 50 years ago, in 1973. It went out to, it was a NASA probe, out to explore the asteroid belt and swing by Jupiter. And ever since then, it's kept going, and it's now 110 astronomical units from us, an astronomical unit being the mean distance between the Earth and the Sun, and it's travelling at 40,000 miles per hour of every second of every day.
Yeah. That's remarkable. And,
but it has been, although there, it was launched about 4 years before the Voyagers are going fast. The Voyagers are now further away than Pioneer. And it's calculated that in about 4 million years, it will pass fairly close to a certain star. And mm-hmm. it's heading towards of an unpronounceable name. But I'll have a look at it and see if I can master the pronunciation of that name. But, John, in the meantime, the big, well, I think the most exciting news story is there are people going back to the moon. Now, there have been only 24 people who have been as far as the moon. 12 of them have actually walked on it. Mm-hmm. I think one or two of them have been there twice, James Young and Alan Shepard. Not sure exactly. I'm sure Encyclopedia Lanica, if he's listening this evening, will tell us.
Just but, a moment. Just coming through now, sir.
Yes. Yep. But, of course, up to now, all those 24 people have been male, white males, Americans. But things are about to change for this particular launch, which is planned the end of next year, or maybe slightly early in 2025.
It's quite exciting, I must say. The four people involved are pilot Victor Glover and Reid Wiseman. He's there as well. We have Jeremy Hansen and Christina Koch. And she was up there for a very long time. I don't know the exact time she spent in space, but she's well.
She holds the record for longest continuous stay, 330 days.
It's remarkable.
Almost a year. Mm. And she was also part of the first all-female spacewalk.
Brilliant.
So she's
well experienced.
She is. I think there's only one of them hasn't been there before. Is that the pilot?
I think that's Victor Glover. Now, I did watch them on NASA TV this morning. They were doing an address to the nation, I suppose, and it's good to watch as well. And they certainly can hold themselves against, and with a microphone as well, so they're well versed in what they're doing. So, and no doubt all the practice over the years has certainly helped them on their way. So there we go. So they all have their own stories, and as the time goes on, as they're working together more, little stories will come across them, and we'll keep an eye on that and forward them on as soon as we possibly can. We've had an awful lot of space or sunspots and solar storms coming in. I don't know whether you've seen any of the auroras that are floating around. There's pictures everywhere.
No, I got some heads up on some of them, but I went out to have a look, but I didn't see anything. But I was in the light pollution at the time.
Yeah, well, the trouble is where we are down lower, it's quite hard to see because it's bright lower. It's okay up higher, above 30 degrees or thereabouts. Lots of photographs appearing in all of the space magazines of the aurora. Now, it's a little bit different down here, because you get a more of a spread glow. You get a red to start, and then as the evening goes on, it turns to green. Whereas if you're up in the northern point, up near the North Pole, I suppose, you get to see them waving and twisting and shaping. They're more defined as well. So we had just recently a strong solar storm. It's the biggest one for the last 6 years. It slammed into Earth, and it caught its forecasters by surprise. And it was the most powerful solar storm in nearly 6 years, and that was just last week. But strangely, space weather forecasters did not see this at all. And the geomagnetic storm peaked as a severe G4 on the 5-grade scale. So little bits and pieces had to be moved out of the way, like the International Space Stations, and rocket launches delayed by 90 minutes and all that sort of stuff. So geomagnetic storms are disturbances to Earth's magnetic field caused by solar material from the coronal mass ejections. And because we're closing in on solar maximum over the next couple of years, we're only going to see a few more. So they will have to make avoidal, because the radiation involved in this is something else. It is and has put out satellites and electric grids and everything as well, back down here on Earth as well. So it's quite a serious thing. And it point directly at us, which is even, well, I suppose it's even worse, but it's fantastic to see that it generates the Aurora Borealis up here for us and the Aurora Australis down below. So the Australis tends to be more red, and the northern hemisphere in the Borealis tends to be green. It's just the way it is. And I did, when I was up in Norway a couple of years back, and it was solar minimum, unfortunately, but we get there again. I did bump into an Australian, and he did say that he's an Aurora hunter, if you like, and he says that the Australian auroras are much, much redder than the ones up in this part of the hemisphere, which are green. And prominently green, so that's something interest. It is. It's quite amazing.
Wonder why that is.
I don't know.
Thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and me, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. We'd love to hear from you. Just I want to go back to the Artemis 2 again, because I think it's worth mentioning again. Of course, we're going to have the first, as NASA described, the first woman to go as far as the moon, which you mentioned, the first person of color, as they say, and also the first Canadian. And it's going to be about a 10-day journey, and they're going to check out, of course, all the functions of the spacecraft before Artemis 3, which is planned to land on the moon, around near the south pole of the moon. But actually, that craft that's going to go down to the moon hasn't flown yet, so I don't know when that's going to happen. They will be in a very high orbit when around the Earth, over 2,000 kilometers, unlike, say, the International Space Station, which is in very low Earth orbit. And then, of course, when they fire off to the moon after, I think, doing a few orbits of Earth, it will be what they call a free return. Normally, of course, when you go to the moon, you would then fire retro rockets to slow down to be captured by the moon's orbit. But I think they're just going to swing around once and very far beyond the moon, a couple of thousand kilometers beyond it, and then come straight back.
It'll be absolutely amazing, because going back into the 60s, we only had sort of black and white photographs, and the clarity wasn't as good. So what's going to come back from this, as they take pictures to the windows with the modern cameras and everything else, I would say would be absolutely mind-boggling. Better luck now, they can get us some close-ups of some of the landers, like the Apollo 11 mission. The 17 is one that sticks out with me most, because there are huge, big, long tracks of the rover beetling up and down, backwards and forwards, and there are some good photographs that are floating around.
Thanks to Anne for texting in on 087-179-1032. I knew he'd know who the guy who the guys would be who have been beyond Earth or far beyond Earth orbit more than once. Lovell Young and Cernan. That's Jim Lovell. Eugene Cernan, I've forgotten Young's first name at the moment. He said they're the only astronauts to leave low Earth orbit twice of the 24 Americans who I mentioned have been as far as the moon.
Yeah, now I've been repeatedly watching Professor Brian Cox's videos, DVDs, of all the different programs that he's put ahead, anything from The Wonders of the Universe to the new one called Universe. And he just has a very easy way of describing things to the layman, if we call it, to explain how exactly things happen. But it always comes back to the Big Bang. And one of the things he was talking about was what was there before the Big Bang. So the Big Bang, as he describes it, is not an actual bang. Well, first of all, you wouldn't hear anything in space if it suddenly went bang, because the sound doesn't travel. Can you imagine it? But what he described it as before that was oceans of energy being transformed into matter. Now, that actually describes it very, very well. So from this, the oceans of energy and the inflation and then the Big Bang, and this happened in billionths of a second. And then about 300,000 years later, the stars started to form. So there was this soup of matter. So we're talking about just sort of little wavy, flickery energy waves, and they've been transformed into matter. And then eventually the denser regions, areas collapsed, and then they formed the stars and the universe itself. And of course, 9 billion years later, our sun and the planets formed, and another 4.5 billion years later, life started to exist on our fine planet that we live on here. So these strange ripples were the thing that formed before the Big Bang. It's still hard to understand, but it's starting to make sense. And the more I just keep repeatedly watching the DVDs, and it, funnily enough, it's on television at the moment as well, The Universe. And he has watched the ones on the Milky Way and the Big Bang itself. So it's, as he says himself, we used to look into the sky and only see questions. Now we are starting to see the answers. Yeah, this is because of the telescopes that we have, and they're starting to see further back in time.
Do we not consider this that the Big Bang is when time itself began, and the laws of not long after, when the laws of physics as we know them?
Well, that's what he's saying. There was just energy before that. There was no matter. Mm. So it's just
infinitely dense, infinitely small.
It's still
universe, but
yeah, and we're talking about trillions of stars forming in billions of seconds. You know, the meat behind the stars. So it took 300,000 years, about 300,000 years in this soup of matter before things stretched out and started to separate. And we have seen back that far. It's like a plasma blob, which is where the hydrogen and helium have started to form, and this is what's formed all the stars. So we up there with our sun have a big ball of hydrogen and helium with nuclear reactions happening every second of every single day for the next, what, five billion years.
So thank you, Alan. It was just the astronomer, John Young. I should have remembered that. John Watts Young. Thank you for that. John, the other big news item, I think, well, the one that made mainstream news this week was Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Orbit, which is a terrible pity. I don't know how much of, as you know, we covered a few weeks ago when they tried to launch the first satellite launch from British soil. Well, the rocket itself was strapped to the underside of an aircraft, and as it took off from Cornwall and went out over west of and south of Ireland and west of Cornwall, and dropped its rocket, and it fired, but it didn't reach orbit. I don't know how much that had got to that failure had got to do with it, but it seems a shame that they have filed for in the United States for Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
Yep, and seemingly they are starting to lay off about 85% of the employees. That's around 675 people, and that's to reduce the expenses due to the inability to secure sufficient funding. And funding is the big thing, because they haven't been that successful in general. So I'm sure they've just had a meeting around the table and said that enough is enough. It's time to let somebody else get in there and just continue on what's already there, because it's a ready business. If you have big, deep pockets.
Should find, a buyer.
I think
maybe there's...
maybe it's all...
Because it is reckoned that commercially space is going to be worth billions and billions of euros and dollars. And then in the years ahead, the demand for little satellites will be such, and not so little as well. Now, see, scientists have observed the flattest explosion ever seen in space. Normally, explosions would be spherical, especially in space, when stars explode, because they're spherical, they would go, everything, the mass would expand, and the explosion itself would be of a spherical shape. But These astronomers have discovered a very rare class of explosion, and they're saying this particular one is the flattest explosion they have ever seen, and it's a big one as well, as explosions go. This explosion, they say, is the size of our own solar system. They're saying very little is known about these types of explosions. They just don't behave like exploding stars. They're too bright. They evolve too quickly. They're weird, and we need more observations to say to find out exactly what it is that caused them. And this explosion was, they measured a distance, so it's about 180 million light years away, and they say it's the most aspherical ever seen in space, with a shape like a disc emerging a few days after it was discovered. And they discovered it quite by accident. He said, what we know for sure is that levels of asymmetry recorded are a key part of understanding these mysterious explosions, and it challenges our preconceptions of how stars might explode in the universe. But they think there was that it was a star that exploded, but it had a disc of material around it in a plane, like the solar system itself. There would be not a spherical cloud around it, but a thin, relatively speaking, cloud of dust going around this star before the star exploded. And it's more or less that disc of material that they're seeing, but they're saying it's the flattest explosion they've ever seen in space. Well, and the size of the solar system, so thank goodness it's 180 million light years away.
I did want to go into a little bit into the way that they're describing now the universe as being a big flat pancake. And usually when we see this, it's a bit like a tube just growing wider and wider. But now they say that it's a big pancake. We'll go into that again later on. The Japanese have postponed the H-2A rocket launch after the H-3 failure. And the reason for this, and they're going into... the original one was supposed to be launched in May, but they're going to postpone it till August. And the reason for this decision was made as the rocket shares components in the second stage engines, of which the successor, its H-3 rocket, was forced to self-destruct shortly after takeoff, just towards the end of March. Mm. So I can see the point that if they're sharing bits and pieces, they'll have to decide, if they've got to modify some bits and pieces.
Yeah, so those two types of rockets, they say, as you say, they share some of the same type of material, so they've postponed it. That was the flight that where the second stage didn't ignite correctly. Yeah, and they think that was most likely caused by an excessive electrical current shutting off the power inside the rocket's second stage engine. So, but hopefully things will go well from there on in. And, that's all the time we have this evening. Thank you, John, for your news items. Thanks, too, to the people here who put this program up as a podcast, and also to James Sweeney and Conor Lennon for putting it up on astronomy.ie and also as a podcast. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of The Astronomy Show on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Up next, it's Hello China, 9 o'clock. It's Bren Leinart with Threads. 11 p.m., we have Nigel Woods with Ear to the Globe and his mix of world music. And then from midnight to 2 a.m. we have After Hours with Dave Barry and his mix of jazz, blues and soul. And he's on till 2 a.m. But please join myself and John at the same time next week when we'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care, Shudder. Thank you for listening. Say good night, John.
And a very good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.